So for the many years that I've been playing in Chicago, one of the best friends I've made living there is Patty Vasquez. She's a comedian, and I remember when she started out, and she was always lovable and funny, but now she is a fire-breathing dragon. She's throwing down comedy thunderbolts and kicks so much ass. I think she lived in L.A. for a little bit, but she's just stayed in Chicago, and she's one of the premier comedians there, and someone I love to death. And here she is.
Hooray, I'm with Patty Vasquez in Chicago on a very rainy day in Zanies. I've never been here in the daytime, so that's kind of strange. But Patty, I worked with you like 15 years ago when you were emceeing.
Not that long ago. Let's say it was 8. Let's
okay, it was have. 3 years ago.
It makes us both
ago.
Younger. Yeah, it's better sure. to lie about how long it's been rather than how old we are, I think. Yeah, it's a better way to measure. So let's say 8 years ago.
Okay, sure. Whatever you like.
Thank you.
And and you were lovable then, and I think every comedian that worked with you had a huge crush on you.
Oh, get out of here. Don't say that. That's so weird.
No, it's really true. I mean, but you were really lovable, and you were really likable, and I saw you last night, and God, I was so proud of you, because you're a monster headlining comedian. And then I found out afterwards, you were filling time. You were only going to do like 5 minutes.
Yeah, I was hosting for the all-female, all-funny show, and they said, well, Emily's going to be a little bit late, so just do 5. And I look up at the clock. There's a clock on stage. And I was like, okay, that was 10. And then 10 minutes later, I'm like, okay, that was 20. And then I had to stop. That's when I stopped, and I was like, okay, can you just give me a ballpark? Are we going to keep going? Yeah, that was filling time.
So you were killing, and your material is smart and funny and very powerful. And I wanted to start with, you know, 8 years ago.
Good winking. That was a good verbal wink. Did you hear? That was a nice inflection 8 years ago.
Chicago was really a male-dominated comedy society. I mean, I think comedy is male-dominated to begin with. But, I mean, where are those guys now? And you really slugged it out. And I would say you're one of the premier best comedians in Chicago at the moment.
Thank you.
All those guys that probably gave you a hard time, they're working at Starbucks.
Well, that might be where I end up, so who knows? It all goes around, comes around. I was going to move to L.A. in 2001, and my dad got sick. And I decided, if I'm not going to move to L.A., then I have to, my next goal, rather than, you know, trying to go after all that, is to be the best I can in Chicago, whatever that ends up being. So that's what I focused on. So thank you for saying that, because that was my goal. Now what, though? See, you said that goal. Now I have to have another goal. It's overwhelming.
Yeah, no, I was wondering about that, because, I mean, you are very attractive and you're very funny. I mean, like, I think television would be tailor-made for you. So I was wondering why you didn't bust out of Chicago and ever make that plunge. I thought maybe you had fallen in love.
I think you met my husband 8 years ago. I think we went out for burritos and stuff with Steve, my husband. And we were just dating then. No, it's all family based. It's all, my dad got sick, and when he passed away, my mom was still working and she was alone. I couldn't see leaving her. And then Steve and I decided to start a family and we wanted to raise them here. So it's all gone around. I mean, I decided this is what I wanted. I wanted to have a family and do stand-up comedy, not be a comic who maybe someday, you know, would try to have a family. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't see it that way. So instead I write one-woman shows about my heritage or about my family, and I do those. So, and as far as TV goes, I'm trying, you know, I go out for meetings and yeah, I'm working on it.
I think you're in a good spot, and I think, you know, you're having a regular life as a regular person, and there's, you know, there's more of a well to bring material from instead of you living in a tiny studio apartment in Hollywood and doing 5-minute sets everywhere.
Exactly. And I look, my friends that have moved out there have done really well. Guys that I knew, like Jimmy Pardo and Graham Elwood, a bunch of those guys, they do really well. Some people are writers. Carla Felicia wrote for the Jamie Gertz show. I can't remember which one that was. It was a really good show, but she's done very well for herself. But, you know, everyone's got a different path, and I try not to have any regrets, you know. Would I have liked to have gone out to L.A.? Would things be different? Of course they'd be different, but this is the route that I chose, and I'm sticking to it.
And you have nothing to be ashamed of, because you're a killer monster comedian now.
I mean,
a lot of people, I think, you know, L.A. kind of crushes your spirit, and you can't do long sets. And, I mean, you can do one-man shows, one-woman shows
right.
at the little you know, Comedy Central Theater and stuff, but it's not very common. How did your father die?
He was a lifetime smoker. He had lung cancer. And it was small cell lung cancer, which is different than the ones that we think of where you can have, you know, to have a lung removed or contain it. It travels through the body. It travels through your bloodstream. It travels through your spine, through your brain. So, it was pretty aggressive, but he was such a big influence in my life. He was the kind of guy that loved talking to strangers, liked to make people laugh, just had such a, like, he would practice stories. He was going to tell his friends at the Dunkin' Donuts. He was a lifelong comedian who just, you know, never professionally, never in front of an audience. But he would do the same story, and he would do, you know, he would fix the jokes here and there. When I was driving into chemo one day, he goes, I wish they hadn't shown you that stuff when you were in kindergarten. And I had come home from kindergarten apparently crying, saying, Daddy, Daddy, your lungs are black. Because they had shown us this thing about what smoking does to your lungs. And I was like, well, because I spent my whole life begging him to stop smoking. And here I was driving him around for chemo and radiation, but I kind of felt like my whole life, I really prioritized spending time with him. I always knew that he was going to go pretty fast. So we went to Cooperstown, went to the Baseball Hall of Fame. We bought a movie on 60mm that he'd seen when he was a kid, and we rented the projector and everything to watch it because it never was available on VHS or DVD. We did all the things that you do when this might be it, and it was kind of nice. I know it sounds weird, but we sort of did and said everything we needed to say.
That's beautiful. And yeah, I was curious because my father died in November.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it's terrible. And I'm still dealing with the grief. But my father was also hysterical. And the reason I'm a comedian, a really funny guy, and like you're saying, a guy who should have been a comedian, but he wasn't. But I can relate to what you're saying because now that he's dead, all I want to do is go home to Florida and hang out with my mom.
Right, right. And that was why I stayed in Chicago, was for my mom. And my dad asked me to look out for your ma, right? And how do you not follow through on that? I will say this. It is weird. Last night when I talked about what it's like to wake up in the morning and realize I have kids, you know, and like, what am I going to do today? You know, that's phantom feeling of my life still being there. You have that for a long time, too, when you lose somebody. You forget, like, you have that hang time when you wake up. And, like, one of the urges you have is to call that person.
I think that all the time. I wake up, and I'll be lying there, and I'll think, oh, I need to call my dad. Yeah. And then a few minutes later, I think, oh, shit, he's dead.
Yeah, yeah. And that takes a long time, too, because you have that urge to, you know, to say, and you there are things that happen. You're like, dad. Would have liked this or this would, and then you start thinking in their voice. I start thinking in my dad's voice, the way he would react to certain situations. I hear him like responding a lot. I know that sounds a little weird, but I know what his take on life would be.
What were some of the funny things that your dad would say? Because my dad had a.
But see, my dad was really, he was old Chicago. I mean, like some of his stuff would be a little racist or a little, you know, sizist. Like when my dad would see somebody who was a little heavy, would say, she ain't missing any dinners. You know, things like that that were a little bit cruel. But he was a guy who would make those kinds of jokes, but still treated everybody with respect. Like he would never treat somebody differently one-on-one that was a different race or a different size or even, you know, it was crazy. There's a great restaurant across the street in VCO. It's a tapas restaurant. And my dad always called homosexuals fruits. That's what he would always be like. He got really mad when they closed down Halsted. He was a cab driver. And they closed down Halsted for the gay pride parade. And he goes, they're closing down Halsted because the fruits got to march. I don't know why they got to march. They dance every day of the year. And that's the kind of thing he would say. Only I was at, so my whole life I thought, oh, he says these horrible things about, you know, about gays, about blacks, about Hispanics. And I was at the restaurant. And I told the waiter, he was a really nice waiter, Max, and he sat down, he was talking to me, telling about all the things in the menu, and I said, well, I'm Patty Vasquez, I do comedy across the street, and he goes, and he put his hand on my arm, and he goes, was your dad Larry? And I said, yes, and he goes, your dad used to give me and my boyfriend rides around town for free. He would pick us up and let me know when you're going to be done. I'll pick you up and give you a ride home. And I had no idea that he was doing this for these guys. And I guess one of the things he said to them was, well, maybe you guys got it right because all these broads are crazy. You know, and he would say things like that. So he was a totally different person from the way he sounded, which was something I'm glad that I learned. And I knew that before he passed away, a couple years before he passed away. I had the opportunity to see him treat people really well. We were at a restaurant near my house, predominantly white neighborhood, and a couple came into this restaurant. it was a black woman and a white guy, and everybody at all the other tables was like, were saying things like, ah, this place is really going downhill. They're letting anybody in here. And I thought my dad was going to say the same thing, and he got up and went to the loudest table, and he said, every time you open your mouths, you show everybody in here how ignorant you are. Why don't you pay up your tab, tip your waitress, and get the hell out so we can all enjoy our evening. And that was the kind of thing he would do.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty remarkable. And then, of course, I thought, he's not going to hell. This is so cool. Yeah, I felt really relieved. I mean, it was like almost saving him in my eyes, you know, because we fought all the time with the way he talked. It drove me crazy.
Yeah, I tried to correct my dad on things, too. And then there came a point where I was like, well, you got to let the old guy be the way he is.
Yeah.
But some of it was pretty funny. Like, my dad was really irritated by sports players who point to God after they do something.
The
kiss the fingers and point to God thing. And we were watching the Little League World Series a few years ago. And the United States was playing Mexico, and a lot of the Mexican kids are really religious.
Absolutely.
And this kid hits a double, and he, like, touches his heart, and he kisses his fingers, and he points up to God, and my dad goes, God doesn't give a fuck about you, kid. It was not divine intervention that got you that double. It was your own hard effort.
Oh, but see, he wanted the kid to take responsibility and be able to own up to his own success. That was sweet.
It was very sweet. Now, I was wondering, because I want to talk to you, you know, you mentioned you have kids, and you have great material about that. I want to come to that in a minute, but I don't want to jump over, you know, your development as a comedian and as a female comedian. Like, mm-hmm. How difficult was it being on the road as a very attractive female?
Well, you know what's weird about that?
Mexican,
like,
huh?
Well, I never got hit on. Like maybe a couple comics made advances, but I there weren't that many. I dated one comic in Chicago. And other than that, like, even, like, audience members, like, I never got hit on the road. There were a couple knocks on my door here and there. I had to spend sometimes weeks in condos with other comics. And that was, you know, most guys were very respectful and very nice. The harder thing I had was a lot of clubs didn't want to book me. They would say, well, you know, women don't do that well here.
We're not really.
And one guy wanted me to send a tape. And I said, oh, so you get tapes from comics. I said, because he had gotten a referral, like, from a headliner who wanted to bring me with. And that wasn't enough for him. And he said, no, I just only for the – he told me, he literally said, just for the women. I want to make sure that it's appropriate for this room. And I go, well, how much are you paying for the week? And he told me it was like 400. And I go, you know what? I said, I can make that much money to stay home. So why don't we just call it even? I go, I don't need to go to somewhere in Minnesota. And I ended up going back out on the road, and I worked for 6 years, all over the Midwest, you know, North Dakota. We were talking last night about how I took Amtrak everywhere. So that was one way
Tell that story. Like, you didn't like to drive.
I didn't like to drive. I didn't like, because a lot of times you have to drive 8 hours between gigs. So what I would try to take Amtrak to the first gig and try to get a ride with the other comics somewhere else. Because if I drive by myself, I can't. After 4 hours, I start getting sleepy, or I'd be on the road in the middle of the night, and I wouldn't have enough money to get a hotel room. So I had to sleep in the car, and that's scary. When you're alone. So I tried to, when I take naps, I would always sleep in church parking lots. I hope that people won't bother you. Someone told me I should have fallen asleep in police parking lots, but that seems, I don't know. That seems like you're asking for trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then the police will touch you inappropriately.
Right. Yeah, so I...
Better a man of the cloth.
Whoa! But I...
No, that's smart that you slept in church parking lots. But, because I've slept in rest areas for years when I was on the road, and then Michael Jordan's father got killed, and I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow, I thought it was safe to sleep in a rest area.
I never did. Truck stops and stuff like that, I couldn't park at. It was scary, but there was a windstorm in Nebraska one time, and I couldn't keep the car on the road, so I had to pull over, and it was like 3 a.m, so I was like, I guess I'm going to sleep at this church. But as far as being a woman, and even in Chicago, and I love Bert Haas, but Bert would pull me aside and tell me that he didn't think my material was appropriate. Like, but you know, different places would say, it's not really, you know, I don't really see where you're going with this. And I don't know how much it happens to anybody. I mean, maybe it happens to guys too, where the managers of the club try to tell you to, you know, push you in a certain direction or not. But for me, it was always, they would tell me to keep it clean. And this is the advice I give to other comics, is you can't, if there's something you want to say, find a way to say it. And still get work. That's the trick, is that you want to keep getting work. I always wanted to keep working for Zanies. So, you know, I had to sort of walk that fine line. But what happened was Puppetry of the Penis came into town. Are you familiar with that? Yeah. And they hired me to be their opening act. I was their opening act when I was pregnant. And I showed up, and they said, well, here's the first thing we want to tell you. Whatever you do, the dirtier the better.
You just patted your stomach, and you said, obviously, I've already seen this show.
Exactly. That's what I used to open with. This has nothing to do with this performance. This was not a byproduct of the show. But they told me the dirtier, the better for the material. So then it was, I'd never had to think about what I was going to say next. I could just say whatever was on my mind. And for 3.5 months, for 10 shows a week, I just said whatever I want. And that was how I made that jump. From being, you know, sort of a middle act who was okay. And I started headlining after that. I started doing Pregnant Party Girl, and I started headlining for Zanies. And I'm still, I have a pretty big gap to jump still. I'm not a household name. I haven't been on Last Comic Standing. I haven't been, you know, enough on Comedy Central. So a lot of clubs don't know who I am. The name probably doesn't help, being a Latino, especially now, you know.
No, I think that helps you tremendously.
I would hope so, but I don't.
Oh my God! Like the Mexican community and the Black community really, and the gay community,
right?
Really support their comedians, and it's the white people that really anger me, because you know, all they can get behind are, you know, redneck comedy tours and things.
Well, there you go. I'm
half Argentinian, and I want to point that out.
I did not know you were half Argentinian. I think we probably did talk about that last.
Yeah,
time.
We talked about it a long time ago. It's a little known fact. My mother is from Buenos Aires, and because they're the light skinned Latinos, nobody. I mean, I should be on the Latino shows.
But I don't speak any Spanish, and people never believe that I'm Mexican. I did a show last week for Cinco de Mayo, and they agreed I did not look Mexican. The white people, the Black people, and the Latinos all agreed I did not look Mexican. Although I guess Latinos are considered white. I was going over the census thing. They had a very specific category on the census. I don't know if you noticed, but it has a whole separate line for Hispanic heritage, I guess. Because when I did it last time, I wrote in, because it said white, and it didn't have a category for Latino. So I think that a lot of Latinos probably wrote in, well, I'm not white. I mean, because white people don't consider Mexicans to be white, I don't think. If a Mexican moved into the neighborhood, you'd be like, there's another white guy on the block. You know? So I think that they did they were trying to be very specific, mostly for Latinos on the census this year. It was interesting. But I identify with being Mexican, you know, especially when I applied for college. I'll be honest, it helped. It helped. I got some scholarship money. What are you going to do? I identify that way. I don't speak Spanish, though. I wish I did.
I don't speak Spanish either. And it's been like I took the pilgrimage. I've been 3 times to Argentina now to meet my family there.
You're right. And do any of them speak English?
Only a couple of them speak a little English. But they just think I'm the best listener in the world, because I just smile and nod.
That's the best way to do it. I have a sister.
God, I hope the guy comes back. He's such a good listener.
He's so sweet. My sister, I have a sister who does not speak very much English. I mean, my mom had children in Mexico City before she moved here. And so at my wedding, my sister Dora would say to people, she would say, hello, my name is Dora. It's very nice to meet you. And then people would start talking to her. I'm sorry, that is all the English that I know. And that would be it. She's so beautiful and has this wonderful smile that everyone just wanted to talk to her. It's like, no, I do not speak English. Thank you very much. That was it for my whole wedding.
That's funny. Yeah, I have a cousin in Argentina, and she told me all the English I would need to know is beer and fuck you. I mean, that's what she thinks would get her by in the United States.
In the United States?
She's not a blood cousin. She's a cousin married to a cousin. And speaking of the Mexican heritage, even though you don't speak Spanish, you are the one that hipped me to the Mexican, the massive Mexican community that's in Chicago. Eight years ago, you took me
that was very, a good verbal
some
link.
Really great burrito places that were just mind-blowing. And then you told me about the strong community here.
It's huge here. And when we go to L.A. and we pitch the show, because we're pitching this show about my family and how my mother and my father met, we always have like the numbers that this is the second largest Mexican population in the United States. And I do a show called Tequila and Shamrocks, and I do the numbers. I write down the numbers. In 1850, there were 9 Mexicans in the state of Illinois, and by 1900, there were only 111, which I'm guessing was self-generated. But after that, they attracted Mexicans to Chicago for the stockyards during World War I, World War II. They were invited to come here and work, and that's how the community got established. And I have to imagine that they took the trains up. My guess is they came probably around May, April at the earliest. Because if a Mexican knew how bad it was in December or January, there is no way they would have gotten off that train. There's just no way they would have turned around and gone. Because my mom still to this day, I ask her, why Chicago? And she always says, I wasn't planning to stay. Because I don't think they do. I don't think anybody plans to stay.
It's, yeah, that's what I think is so mind-blowing, because it's so freaking cold here that why would Mexicans come here? I mean, you know.
Yeah, it's gruesome here in the wintertime. It is, and she has, like, weather amnesia. She forgets how bad and nasty it's going to be. So now what she does is every year, every January or February, she takes 1 month and goes back to Mexico for an entire month so that she can at least, like, you know, have that piece of her life back.
But have you been with her?
I've been to Mexico. I've never spent a month down there, but we go to Puebla, which is a beautiful town in Mexico. Taxco is wonderful. Mexico City is really... Have you been to Mexico City? Mm-hmm. It is huge. It is like... It is a dry, dusty New York, but even bigger, more sprawling. I mean, the population in the metropolitan area is like 25 million. It might even be more by now, which is crazy. All the streets are four lanes in each direction. I mean, it's just a massive collection of humanity. When you land, the clouds are brown. That's how much pollution there is there. It's so bad. Wow. Yeah. My mom loves going to Mexico City. I like going to the towns, throughout the mid parts of Mexico are wonderful. And the coastal areas, like Puerto Vallarta, is wonderful. But it's sad. Whenever I go, I do love it when white people try to speak slowly and loudly to me. Because I guess when I go down there, I look dark. And people talk to me loudly and slowly. Do you know? Oh, man, they think I'm Mexican, which is fine. But I'm like, this is how they must feel when someone talks to them, like they're not mentally capable of understanding anything. But I don't. And then when I go down there, I can speak some Spanish with a really good accent because my mom's voice. So Mexicans will start talking to me very quickly, thinking that I understand the language. And I don't. I sound mentally incapable because I'm like, no puedo hablar en español. I can't possibly process this fast.
I spent $500 on the Rosetta Stone.
Did you really?
I did.
I'm fascinated. I'm kind of curious.
Before I went, and I did it, like, but the last time I went, I did it for like 2 or 3 months before I went. I spent $500. And
is it really $500?
This is for 1, 2, and 3. And I didn't get past course 1, but this is what I learned. Un bicicleta es verde.
Is your bicycle green?
Yeah, and I hope the next time I go, I can say my bicycle is purple.
Oh, wait. What is morado?
El gato es negro.
Which is bad luck. I minored in Spanish. I have a minor in it on my diploma.
You said you didn't speak Spanish, but you knew exactly what I was saying.
Oh, yeah, I know. Isn't that advanced? It's so advanced. Yeah, no, I'm not very good at all.
But now you were talking about, you still have some milestones to go with television and things. But now the Just for Laughs Festival is doing a Chicago thing.
Yeah, they're coming back.
And that's where all the people scout talent, Montreal, it used to be big deals got signed. But
I know. I did it last year, and Henry Cho and I were outside. He taped right before I did. And then we were outside, and I had a nice set. It was a very nice set. I really made sure I had a very tight, I made sure that I knew exactly what I was going to say, and I wouldn't have any, I wouldn't panic, because it was my first time on national television. And we went outside, and this guy came up to me and introduced himself, something blah, blah, blah of TBS. And Henry was giving me this look like, that's the president of TBS. And I don't know what I said to him.
Said, Bill Engvall, really?
I'm like, okay, sure, whatever. And I'm pretty sure I like turned my back on him. I have no idea. So apparently that's how deals don't get made. Yeah, I remember Henry giving me this look like, seriously, talk to him. I'm like, and he introduced himself to me. All I heard was wah, 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 wah of TBS. Okay, whatever. So that's how good I am at making deals happen for myself. I can't schmooze. Are you a good schmoozer?
Yeah, but I don't think it really matters. I think that I think your advantage is in being a woman and being extremely funny. And I don't, the stereotype of, we've all heard it in comedy. I mean, and you can feel it when a woman walks on stage, the audience kind of folds their arms a little bit and like, okay, this is going to be whatever. But I mean, there's some brilliant female comedians. I've never subscribed to that attitude. I think Maria Bamford is brilliant.
Absolutely.
A lot of other comedians, and I think you're a monster. I think you're going to get found out sooner or later.
I'm being very patient. I was just in Houston, and I get it. I get it. Maybe a couple times a month where someone says, you know, no offense, I don't usually like female comedians, but you were really funny. In Houston, I got it every show, like two or three times a show, people on the way out. And I did get one woman who told me, this really beautiful black older lady who had to be like in her 70s. She said, you are my favorite comedian I've ever seen. Now, you use some language I don't appreciate, but I'll forgive you for that. And it was so sweet because I do some things that are people will think is a little off color. But I'll tell you something, 80-year-old ladies, 70, 80-year-old ladies come up to me and tell me I'm adorable no matter what I've just said. And I love that. I have a joke about how after I had kids, a woman asked me if I was still loose down there. And I mean, what a personal question, but that's how honest my show is that people want to talk to me after the show. And I was very honest and I said, well, as long as you do your Kegel exercises, as long as you squeeze your flower, you can snap right back into shape. And these women were leaving the show. They had to be in their 70s. And these women go, so whose flower's still tight, ladies? You know, and I mean, it was awesome. Who else is going to get that? You know, I loved it.
What is a Kegel exercise?
It's squeezing your flower. You squeeze and release. Yes, 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 yes. You do it for like a count of whatever, however long you can take, and then you release. It's the muscles of the vagina. Can I say that? I already said it.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought flower was the flower's my cute way of saying it. My Georgia O'Keeffe, but that's the Kegel exercises. Yeah.
I went to the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum in January.
Did you really?
Yeah, I took a little trip to New Mexico. And
she was really angry.
She obviously had a lot more on her mind than flowers.
I know. Well, she was angry that people thought that that's what she was painting. I read this biography on her. She did not appreciate that people thought she was. But I mean, like, come on. Come on. I think that's why she turned to
the Actually her husband was an art guy. I think, I forget where he was. He was big with the Guggenheim or something. In her first show, he wrote some big expose that it was this sexual thing with flowers, and it followed her for her whole career.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I think. Maybe that's why she started doing like cow skulls instead. Go ahead, tell me what that's supposed to be. I dare you. It's a bone. Oh no. I didn't see that one coming. Oh no. I get away with a lot of things, I think, because I have sort of a smile and a curtsy and a, you know, but I say things that are, you know, I do attack the way people behave, you know, the stupid things that people say. And I put it on myself too. I say a lot of really stupid things. I really said to a cashier who was probably 4'4", when he ran out of change, are you short? And then I stood there trying to, do I fix it? I'm high. I don't know what to say. So I do it all the time. We all do it all the time. It's just whether or not you're coming from a place of maliciousness. That's what I have a problem with. People who don't respect others, who have no tolerance for others. But we're all allowed a certain amount of stupidity, and that's why I say the things that I do.
You mentioned that you had some risque material. I'll have to give you a really great compliment. I got lost in watching your show last night. And I don't really, I rarely enjoy a comedian where I'm not like analyzing what they're doing and guessing what the punchline is going to be. I don't recall last night you had too much dirty material.
No, just about my dad catching me was probably the only one when I was tickling my flower. Yes, that was and that's also a true story. That was horrifying.
Your father? I must have been having a cigarette.
My dad caught me. When I was in high school, my dad caught me on the living room couch. And, you know, of course, the living room couch was a bad idea. But, yeah, I just have a story about how he used to say, what are you doing playing with yourself, when I was a kid. And I don't think he realized what that meant. And then one day he caught me, and I realized what he meant, and he never said that to me again. And it was a scarring experience. And the rest of the story was that, you know, he would knock on every door. Hey, Pat, you in the kitchen? I'm coming in. Yeah, Dad, I'm on the table. That rolling pin really set me off. Thanks for asking. But that was the most risque thing that I did last night, because I never knew when I was done last night. I was like, do I get dirtier? Do I go clean? I've already done the stirrups. I've already, you know, well, the girl who went up in front of me, if you remember, had a puppet of a certain sort that
She was very funny. She pulled a puppet out of her pants. It was a vagina puppet.
It was, and there was.
So maybe that's why I thought you were so clean, following the vagina puppet. I was like, oh my god, she's like Lawrence Welk clean.
Well, you know, that's a comedian's job. I do every time I follow her as an MC, Connie Howe, that's the name of the character she does. I always do 5 minutes after she's done anyway, so the next comedian doesn't have to sort of follow that sort of awkwardness of someone just throwing Kotex and tampons at them. Because there was an older lady in the front just kind of like smiling and shaking her head, you know, not quite sure what she had just seen. So, and the other thing with the material last night was I try to set up every little chunk as if it was going to be my last joke. What a weird rhythm to have, you know, like, okay, that wasn't it. Excellent. Let's keep going. What else do I have?
Well, I thought your material was really strong, and you know, I'm your friend. I haven't seen you perform in a few years, and like I said, I really was proud of you. And the thing that I liked the most about it was you had a lot of autobiographical material,
right,
about being a mother and having children, and I don't know. I think just as a woman comedian, you don't see a lot of people diving into the truth of their life like that.
Right.
I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but
I have no shame, and that's what
I think bravery, I think, is
right,
the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, I don't... Well, thank you. I think that was why I got into stand-up, was I always thought I had a good story to tell about my life, the way I grew up, my interpretation of the things that happened to me. Because nothing... It always feels like nothing small happens to me. I mean, and that's just the way I see the world. Everything that happens, I kind of blow out of proportion. I make it dramatic or the way I see it. And including... That's why I'm writing a book of essays, because it's getting to be too much. I have so many different things that I want to talk about that, you know, because it is my perception of the world. I have a chapter called Whatever You Do, Don't Dribble. Because when I was in grade school, I was the tallest person in school at 5'6". I topped out. That's where I am now, and that was what I was when I was 12. And they made me the center of the basketball team, but I had no coordination. So they told me, whatever you do, don't dribble, pass or shoot. So, but that's what it felt like for a long time when I was a kid. Was I was only liked for certain things, but I couldn't. No one wanted me to do anything else, including being funny or telling stories. Like whatever my point of view wasn't important for a long time. Like the boys that I dated, and I kind of put myself, including in stand up comedy, like being told, well, you shouldn't do it that way. Whatever you do, don't dribble. And that's how I felt until I started doing Puppetry of the Penis. And I think that was in at the same time as getting pregnant. When you're pregnant and you say these things that are so off the wall, and as Larry Miller would say, I was working with Larry Miller, and he said tawdry. What a wonderful, delicious word. Tawdry. And I kind of feel special being tawdry. But, you know, I could dribble, I could shoot, I could do whatever I wanted. And that's how I started doing stand-up comedy in 2003. Was doing whatever I wanted. And by the way, Larry Miller, what a delightful human being. Like, I was really nervous. Have you worked with him?
I don't know him, no.
You don't know, do you know who he is?
Of course, yeah.
I was going to say.
Yeah, yeah. 9 million Letterman, of course. Yeah.
But I was working with him at the Punchline in Atlanta, and I was really nervous to open for him. I kept it really clean, and he was really sweet and very, you know, complimentary about the set. And I had to headline a third show Saturday because Larry wasn't going to do it. He goes, well, I'm going to go back. And he knew that I was nervous having him watch my set. And he went upstairs. He didn't tell me he was going to stay and watch my show. And he came back downstairs and he said, you have nothing to be embarrassed about. You are wonderful. You are talented. And you should stand behind that. And I was like, it was very exciting. And he helped me write, he was helping me work on a circumcision bit. Who would have thought? He started giving me the history of circumcision. And how, like, it's how, I didn't know it was a contract with God with the Jews and God. I know, did you know that?
No, I know the Jews invented it, and that's why I've always had such reverence for the Jews, because, God, my penis is really gorgeous.
when we were gonna have boys, I asked my mom.
And you did a bit last night about the circumcision.
Exactly,
yeah.
And when I asked certain, I had never seen one that wasn't. I didn't.
Yeah, it's kind of a Mr. Snuffleupagus anteater nose.
It is.
Thing.
You know, it looks like a roll of nickels. You know what I mean? It's got like that paper that runs around. But anyway, I've never seen one. But so I asked my mom her advice because her son was, and I asked her if she had ever seen one that wasn't, and she goes, "Yes, I was. Oh my God, they stink. I wanted the air around me to explode so I wouldn't have to smell anything anymore." I was like, "Oh my, it's too. It was too graphic. It was too much. It was too much."
What a poetic sentence. I wanted the air around me to explode so I couldn't smell it anymore. Now, I lived in Europe, and I think it's – I think Jewish people and American people,
yes,
and I think Mexicans, you know, the very strong religious people, Christians, are circumcised. But in Europe, it's not a common thing, because I did a joke about Elvis that he was never circumcised. And people in Europe, I would do the after the show, they'd go, "Yeah, that's not that funny because we're
right.
None of us are circumcised." I'm like, "Oh, okay."
Excellent. Yeah, I when we were gonna have Griffin, my first son, like, there's actually a push, a trend toward trying to push people away from circumcisions, but whatever. I, like I said, I left it up to Steve, and he wanted them to look like him, whatever, for what that's worth, I guess. Daddy, how come I don't look like you? I don't know. I don't want to have that conversation.
Yeah.
But no, and then when I was in Copenhagen, I did a show there for, as far as the language goes, and because they told me anything goes. Don't worry about language, talk about sex, talk about whatever you want. And that was cool until I started talking about the stirrups, about a woman's exam. And they don't have a word for that. And they don't talk about such things. All that stuff they talk about, but they don't talk about the exam. And I thought, how weird is that? In America, you know, women are kind of self-conscious about their bodies and you know, we laugh about it and stuff. And yet when I do that bit, it's one of my favorite things to talk about. But in Denmark, oh, we don't talk about such things. Okay.
It's funny, they go, you can talk about whatever you want, nothing's off limits, and you find the one thing that they didn't even know they had a problem with. Yeah. Oh, shit, it's a landmine.
Yeah, I had no idea. Well, they were like, and they were just staring at me. I'm like, seriously? This is the one we're going to stop on? This is where the brakes come out? Yeah. It was a blast being in Denmark. It was very, very cool. Yeah.
So, I mean, what about motherhood and being a mother and being a comedian? I mean, you know, motherhood is universal.
Right.
You know, laughter is hopefully universal. I mean,
sure.
You've got kind of the golden harp from the angels.
And for a couple of years, I kind of got into a rut about talking about just about like 25 minutes of my set would be about motherhood. And I realized it was too much. And it's not something for everybody. There's so many young people that come to the shows too. So I try to sprinkle it in. And also to, you know, when I talk about Declan, who's my younger son, who's disabled, he's missing a small, tiny piece of his brain. So, it's so bizarre all the things that I've learned. When everyone saw Rain Man, they believe that that's what autism looked like. And what they found out later was that he's missing the same part of his brain that my son misses. He's missing the corpus callosum. Declan's is thin. He has some of it. But it means that, like, one side of his brain takes over. And that's why, like, in Rain Man, the character was mathematically able to see things in pictures and numbers. And we don't know what Declan's is yet, but there is a moment where I mention that he's disabled and the crowd kind of goes, you know, they're not really sure how this is going to go. I'm not sure. I don't know if they get uncomfortable, but I try to let them off the hook as quickly as possible that, you know, everybody has to have a sense of humor about everything in their lives. And mine is the way people react to Declan. They stare at him with this look like, what's wrong with that kid? And I stare at them like, what's wrong with you? And I like my life. My world is much bigger having Declan in it. And I like telling people about what it's like to have this kid who's disabled, because it's not a big deal to him how people talk to him. You know, that he's a happy kid who likes, you know, he likes Black Eyed Peas yeah, he loves a little Boom Boom Pow. Oh my God, Fergie. He hears a Fergalicious. He comes running. He loves anything with a nice beat. And I, you know, that's just, it's a different point of view. Like I said, everything I do is autobiographical. I'm not creative enough to write outside of what I know. I'm, you know, and sort of creating I exaggerate my life, but I use almost entire truth. And that's the way I do things.
Well, and talking about your son, Declan, I sat in the audience and watched you last night, which is something I rarely do. and you did the joke about defending him where somebody thought, that he wasn't, I forget how the joke went.
Right.
I just remember the punchline. I don't want to ruin it, but, you did the punchline and I laughed. I looked over at the audience. There was a guy, on the left side of the room and a few other people that like almost jumped out of their chairs. They were laughing and then they clapped like violently, in approval of what you had done. It was really a heroic reaction to what you were saying. Like, you know, you had defended your child from somebody who was judging him,
right.
And I've rarely ever seen a reaction like that from an audience. I mean, it was a tiny audience, but they were like, "Wow!" and so on your side.
It's a surprise. And what that was, have you ever like felt like there's something happening where you might have an argument with somebody? Like you're in a situation where it's the grocery store, and you're like, "Oh, if that guy does this, I'm just gonna give him peace of my mind." And it never happens. But you have that holstered. Like you come up with there's two ways it happens. One, it either happens as you're leaving. You're like, "Oh, I should have said this."
Yeah.
Right. And you try to remember that for next time. Or you do it in anticipation of it happening. And I do a lot of both. I'll see people staring at Declan. I'm like, oh, say something. I'm ready. Let's go. And once in a while it happens. And people, I get tired of people telling me, you know, because Declan does not talk. He has not a single word. He makes some noises. He doesn't have full control of the muscles in his mouth because you need both sides of your brain to control your gross motor skills and your fine motor skills.
He doesn't speak at all?
He doesn't speak at all. And we're working on it. He does a little bit of sign language. You start cognitively, he's delayed too because the brain has a lot of work to do. And his is just, it's just kind of things fall into, into place at a different pace. So people will stare at him and, you know, I get these questions like, well, what's, you know, when's he going to talk? You know, or they'll say, oh, he'll talk someday and then you'll wish he'll shut up. And that drives me crazy because no neurologist has ever made that promise to me that he will ever talk. They don't know. They don't know if he'll talk. But when people don't know my reality and then they come over to me and they sit down and they're like, and I know they've been staring at Declan, and this would happen at a children's museum. This woman was like, you know, your son isn't talking. He really should be talking by now. Just so you know, he should be talking. He really, you know, you need him evaluated. And people will say this. They're like, oh, like as though, like they don't know that from the minute he was born, he wasn't breathing. He had to be resuscitated and put on a ventilator. You know, what a presumptuous thing to come into my that's why I say mental space. To come and talk to me as though she is now going to solve all my problems. It's that tone that I can't stand from people. So, you know, but I had that holstered. My reaction to that attitude I had for a while, which she kept saying, you know, make sure you have him evaluated. You know, people will tell you he'll grow out of it, but, you know, it's better to do it earlier rather than later. And I said to her, well, he's globally delayed. He's actually missing a small part of his brain. So we don't know if he will ever talk. And he's in speech therapy and physical therapy. And just so you know, just because you can talk doesn't mean you should. So maybe you want to look into that. And I was so like, I even felt, are you kidding me? Like the way people respond to that. I was like, I just did it. I said it. That's right. Yeah. And it was one of my favorite moments. And I don't care what people think. If you come over and talk to me, if you open that gate, you better be prepared for what's going to happen next. Don't cross into somebody else's universe unless you have the proper equipment.
I can't believe this was a stranger at the children's museum that just came up to you and said that.
And it happens more often. Like, but people do this to other people's kids. And I can recognize a child who has an issue, whether it's a disorder or a behavioral problem, or just, you know, or parents who don't care. I mean, like, I'm so much more aware of it. I don't involve unless it seems like somebody who's approachable. And you can. There are ways to say, you know, I have a son who has autism. I'm just wondering, you know, where do your children go to school? If you feel like you can kind of work your way in, it's kind of like having a gaydar when gay people know when someone else is gay.
Yeah.
I think parents of special needs children kind of know when they can, you know, sort of approach each other and say, hey, so where do you get your services from? And I see people like my mom was following Declan around one time, and I was taking care of Griffin, my older son, and mom bumped into this older lady, and the lady didn't realize that we were together, and mom was chasing Declan because he doesn't respond to his name, so you have to be right on top of him. You can't let him get very far away. And this woman looked at me and she's like, I guess she thinks she's more important than the rest of us. And I said, actually, my son is more important than everybody, and my mom is trying to keep up with him. I tell people he has autism just because saying he has hypoplasia of the corpus callosum is so hard. Such a mouthful. But the woman, when I said to her that my son had autism, she apologized to me for being mad at my mom and told me that her niece was just diagnosed with autism. See, so if you start that way, you know what I mean, if people just, you know, take into consideration what their lives are like and wonder whether or not they would want someone to impose themselves, you know, in their reality, we would all maybe take a step back. You know, it goes back to how do you want to be treated? Would you want someone to come over and talk to you like that? No, nobody does. It doesn't feel good. So yeah, I'm a little bit, like I said, my mental space is a no-fly zone. I will shoot people down with no radio contact. I don't have time for it.
You are heroic, Patty. I mean, God, I can't believe what a life you've lived since. I mean, I don't know how long it's been since I've seen you.
Well, someday.
It's only been a few years, I think.
I know, but see,
and
I am.
You've gotten married. You've got two children, yeah. And you're wow. It's amazing that you know you can do all of this, and balance a comedy career.
But that's the thing is like I'm balanced. I'm scratching, man. I'm just trying to get more work. I'm constantly, you know, I'm always like when I was younger as a comic, I would book out like 3 to 6 months ahead, and I would be so excited because I'm like, ooh, I'm still gonna be a comic in, you know, in December or whatever, you know, because I still had work coming, and it is.
I know that feeling. Yeah, where you're like, where like when things are lean, you go, Oh, God, my career ends in October.
Yes, that's exactly, mine is September this year. September is my D-Day. I have nothing booked from September on. You know, I have August looks good. This month is nice. So I just gotta, what I'm really hoping is that, and I haven't been able to write a lot of new material lately, I'm hoping that I can get this book done, and that'll be maybe one way for me to get in. One way, I mean, with a book, it's a much stronger vehicle than anything else I can do immediately. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think books are very important, and it's a different kind of milestone. And I definitely think that, yeah, all we have is the art that we've made in our life
right.
to leave behind. So, yeah, I think writing a book is definitely important. But, God, I just lost the thought.
That's okay. Well, it's so funny that you said that, like, so much has happened. I'm going to take your microphone. No, but I mean, like, I couldn't talk then. I couldn't. Don't you feel like when you first started doing comedy, like, you didn't know how to say the thing? You had to, that's a skill that you have to learn. So I had a lot of stuff going on then when I met you 8 years ago, plus seven. But,
yeah, I think that's what I was going to say. And it goes along with the book that, yeah, when you were starting out, I mean, like everybody, you know, this the thoughts of a younger person. I mean,
right.
you're still a very young person, but my God, what life experience that you have! And you talked about all these things in your act last night, and that's what I was blown away by. And I didn't know about your youngest son and all these things. And wow.
I like wow. Wow is I like to wow Tom Rhodes. That's a good feeling.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so much more powerful than jokes, you know, the life experience. You've got so much.
Well, you do a lot, but you do a lot of that too.
I have a lot of.
You do a lot of.
A lot of my things.
But you're
now, because I've been just a gypsy and I've been traveling for like 3 years, I just threw everything into, or 4 years, I threw everything into storage. A lot of my experiences are just traveling. So
but a lot
it'll
of,
be like, hey, I was in Alaska. Hey,
right.
I was in Switzerland. Hey, I was in.
You should write a book. Are you writing a book?
I am, and that's why I. That's why like short stories of
because
of things.
Your comedy has always been about acceptance. This is my. We do the same thing where you put your point of view of how you filter the world, and I've always thought you had such a beautiful way of doing it. Just sort of like everybody's kind of like let's us all kind of have a good time and let's you know let's get along and that's always been the message I always got from your stand up always.
Well, that's great. You haven't seen the bitterness that's come in the last year.
I find that hard to believe.
No, I'm joking.
I find that really hard to believe.
I mean,
whatever
happens.
No,
because
you always find wonder at things. Your material is always about like the awe of life. That's what I always take away from it too. Is like sort of you never stop seeking more from life.
I love you for saying that, and I really needed to be reminded of that because. My father died, and I've just been experiencing a lot of grief and depression. And I don't know. I'm trying to remember the nice, happy Tom.
Well, you don't. Look. I mean, like, but that becomes a part of you. That becomes a part of your filter and how you see that. You know, like what that. You know, with my 6-year-old, like, I get nervous sometimes when I have to travel. Like, you know, he says he's gonna miss me and stuff. And then you have that moment where you go, "What if something happens? What if?" I can't come back to my family. And I always talk to him about, you know, that I'm always in his heart. And that's, you know, it's really heavy stuff. But I say, you know, no matter where you are, no matter where I am, we're always in each other's heart. And that's still how I feel about my dad. Like, I can still – I remember when one of the things I had to do was to try to imagine it, like, being away from him when I was a kid. You know, when I had the same, you know, separation anxiety that my son has, is I try to think of not being with him now as my, you know, going off to Girl Scout camp. And dad will be there. I can still have a good time now and do the things that I love doing and having all these adventures and experiences. And, you know, dad and I will talk about it later. Do you know what I mean? That's how I had a really tough time. I can't believe I'm gonna say this. I just talked to my mom about this. When my dad passed away, I worked so hard to keep him alive. That I didn't, I stopped drinking. We moved into a 2-flat with my parents so that I would be upstairs in case anything happened and I could take care of him. We didn't know how long it would be. We didn't know if it'd be 3 months, 6 months, a year, five mm-hmm. years. So I was always on the ready. I was always, you know, listening to make sure, cause we were told he had also an aortic aneurysm and that it would rupture. Ultimately that was how he died. So I was listening to see if they were moving around and until my mom woke up so that someone would be awake someone was always with him, but I knew that he wouldn't tell me if he was in pain. And they didn't recognize the signs of the rupture. So I had stopped drinking and I was, you know, just trying to be very focused on my dad. And then the day he passed away, I had a glass of wine. And then the next day I had some Jägermeister and And I would wake up and have Jägermeister, and I would have Jägermeister, and I would drink. And I wouldn't, you know, not a lot, probably about 3 or 4 drinks a day, but I would just to keep that sort of that hum going, just sort of like to get through the next day. Because I, you know, when you're in a state of panic, when you're in a state, you know, it's like, it's hard, and not to have the, you know, the outcome that you were hoping for. I mean, you know, to not have it turn out the way you wanted is really hard to deal with. So I drank for 6 weeks straight, just constantly. I mean, like, and then I put myself on a train and I went to the Adirondacks. I went to there's a yoga retreat called Kripala, and I, you know, again, I stopped drinking, and I started eating, you know, whole, they have whole foods, and they do all the, like, the brown rice and the tofu and no meats and stuff, and but it's so beautiful there, and I could clear my head, and I started dreaming again. I hadn't been having dreams like ones that you remember. You know, I know we all dream, but I couldn't. But I had this great dream that Dad and I were sitting on our front porch, and he goes, "Hey, kid, I'm all right. Don't worry about me." And I was like, "Really?" And he goes, "Babe Ruth is up here." And I was like, "Really? Did you talk to him?" And he goes, "Nah, I'm not going to bother him. Everybody wants to talk to him." And that was kind of like, for some reason, I felt really good when I woke up after that dream, whether it's, you know, a self-creation or who knows? Who knows if that isn't? I know. I'm sorry. But that was, and I can say this, and a lot of, I was incredibly close to my dad. People will say, "Oh, it'll get easier with time. It'll get easier with time." I would say it gets different with time. It's always going to be. It just is. It's just the way, you know. I'm sorry. You know, I had, because you have a way, you have an
I'm
image
crying.
Of, I'm sorry.
No, but I think it's really beautiful. And so did you stop drinking so you could remember things about your
yeah,
father?
Well, I stopped drinking. I mean, I was drinking constantly. I wasn't ever sober for 6 weeks. I have cocktails now. I have wine and stuff like that. But I couldn't stop for 6 weeks. I was like, well, this is not a good route to be on. So
I that's one reason why I've been trying to write a lot is I don't want to forget the stories about my dad.
Absolutely.
And I think as time goes on,
yeah,
I will forget, and then it'll just be some distant memory. So that's why I've been trying to, like, write a lot of details about our relationship.
Absolutely. And writing it helps. But it doesn't, like, I can still see the twinkle in his eyes and the smile, and it's been 9 years. And I can sometimes smell him because he was a smoker. So that's one of the reasons I like to have a cigarette once in a while. I have one like at night, and I'm not a big smoker. I have one literally last night. I had two, maybe like one and a half. But when I smell cigarettes, I
know because you bummed them for me.
I know, and I didn't this morning. Did you notice that? No, his memory is extremely strong. Absolutely. And Griffin, and then I pass it along. Griffin sings Take Me Out to the Ball Game. I said, "What's Grandpa Larry's favorite song?" And he's never met his grandpa, but I talk to him about him all the time. And I share stories about him. And he goes, "Well, what would Grandpa Larry, how would he be?" And I was like, "Well, he would joke you. He would tease you all the time. And be like, hey, Griffin, you got a job yet? You got a girlfriend? You married?" You know, he would talk to you like you were an adult. And he'd be like, "I'm too young." And those are the kinds of jokes he would do to you, Griffin. So I do. It's you never forget. I mean, some of the facts and details of stories. Yeah, I think that I wish I'd written more of those down. But I was drinking for 6 weeks. What do you want me to do?
All right, we just took a little break, and in that break, I think you said some of the most profound things ever.
let's leave it at that. That sounds like, yeah.
They were not recorded. But basically, we're talking about dealing with grief, and I liked the sentence that you said, that to go on stage, you have to become somebody else for the people.
Yeah, I mean, they don't know what your pain is, so you get to give them, you know, whether or not they, well, you know, you hope that you're giving them joy, and there's happiness in that. I love what I do, and I do lose myself in that sometimes when I'm going through really hard times. I love doing it.
Well, you're excellent at it, and you just really helped my healing in that, because I'm watching you talk about your son Declan last night, and I'm thinking, oh, wow, God, she's just so open and autobiographical, but, you know, you told me it took you a few years to process everything before you could speak about it on stage, so that actually helps me greatly. But let's turn things to a happier tone. let's talk about Chicago
and
the comedy scene, because there was a very vibrant scene here many years ago. God, there was like 6, 8 clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And to be a Chicago comedian, you never had to, I mean, you know, I guess 15, 20 years ago, you didn't have to travel. There was so much work here. It really dried up supremely. And there's not a big scene. Tell me about the comedy scene. I mean, it's always been more of a improv comedy town, but stand-up there's always been a great tradition of stand-up in Chicago.
I think in the absence of the professional clubs, because when I started was when the bottom fell out. In the 2 or 3 years when I started, the Funny Firm, which became the Fallout, closed. The Improv down the street on Wells closed. There were a couple places like the Comedy Womb, and I didn't like a lot of places that closed before that. There, at one time in the metropolitan area, there were 22 clubs, I've been told. And that was never the case for me. But in the absence of the clubs, an incredibly strong open mic circuit has started. I mean, like, there's some really great places. I don't do them because I've never been that kind. I've never been strong at performing for other comedians or doing kind of like that style of comedy. I think I probably listen to other comics too much.
You mean like alternative comedy?
I guess that's it. Not just alternative. I mean, like, there's such a there's a division between. It might be entirely in my imagination, between comics who feel there's a certain way to do this, and that if you're really good at zanies, well, you're just a crowd pleaser, and you know that's not really. And people have told me that I couldn't do some festival or whatever because I'm too much of a crowd pleaser. Which what a weird negative thing to say.
Right, and that's that's the perception of it is that you get too much laughter to be an alternative.
Well, somehow it's gratuitous. So the things you do are gratuitous. Can I do some stuff that's just silly and tawdry,
you've memorized your jokes and you have polish to them instead of going up and reading off of a notebook.
Right. Well, there's different styles and not that that kind of comedy doesn't evolve into something else, something that becomes crowd pleasing. But I just, for me, it's not a place I feel comfortable doing comedy. I like doing theaters. That's the different route that I took. There's the alternative or the open mic scene. There's the professional comedy clubs like Zanies and the Improv out in the suburbs. And we only have 3 Zanies and then the Improv. And then I think in the south suburbs, there's a few places that do like one-nighters and really, really nice venues. There's also a special events venue that I do a lot of, a lot of Latino crowds. And like you were saying earlier, that the Latinos are very, you know, or African-American audiences are very supportive of their own. And that's what I was always afraid to do all Latin crowds because I'm like, I'm not Mexican enough. But I didn't go out there pretending to be something that I'm not. I would go out and I would do my material, start talking about my mom, and I'm honest. And that's where I found my biggest strength. And then the third, like you said, is improv comedy. And people who ask me, so when are you going to be at Second City? I flinch because it's so hard to explain that it's not the same skill. It's not, comedy, I guess, is sort of this umbrella for stand-up and improv and musical comedy. But it's not.
It's a whole different comedy muscle. This is my impression of me doing improv comedy.
Mine is always, I turn it it's so big. I do that a lot. And let's see how many jokes I can make about it. It's so big. And they always ask not to do that. Plus, you have to sing. You're supposed to sing in improv in Second City and things like that. I took a lot of classes when I started because so many people would ask me if I could improvise.
You took classes at Second City?
I did the Players Workshop at the Second City and graduated from it. But we did a graduation show, and I don't have any musical timing. I can't hear where you're supposed to jump in on the line, right? So they would do like the vamp music and the intro music, and then the line starts. I could never find that jumping in place. So they started taking my lines away from me. And I was like, it was so awkward and uncomfortable for me. I'm like, why would I ever want to do this again? So that was it. I graduated and never did improv again.
I think it's noble that you're from Chicago and that you actually trained and took classes there.
I took improv, but I also went and took theater. I went and studied I didn't finish, but I studied for my master's in theater because stand-up is a performance. It's not, a lot of comics look down on like training or taking comedy classes. You have to have something to draw on. I took voice lessons. I took movement classes. I took writing classes, like writing plays. I learned how to direct plays. I took lighting design. I took costume. And I mean, it's why I wear a very specific outfit on stage. I wear short sleeve blazers and longer shirt, like a little camisole, because there is something to the physical appeal, especially when we're talking about female comedians. I want to wear something that isn't too sexual, that's cute and attractive, but isn't threatening to women and isn't overly like, oh, look at the boobs on her. I have to find that sort of that middle ground of people listening to me for my material. And if, I want to be appealing, but not overly, I always wore vests. They were teasing me last night about the when you said I worked with you 8 years ago. There's a picture of me with, I used to always wear vests and like jeans. Kevin Rogers, who I met before I ever got to work with you, always wore cowboy boots on stage and had this way of like strutting, like you both do. You both have that like really laid back and wonderful presence on stage. So I started wearing cowboy boots because of Kevin Rogers.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, and it's funny you talk about the way you dress because like only a female comedian would have to be conscious of that.
I don't know. I think
I don't think men are, you know, God, I hope I'm not too sexy for the audience.
No, it sounds almost narcissistic of me to say it, but I've been, you know, I know what I, you know, I've always been self-conscious of my body and I don't want that to be a distraction. I am a busty gal. So it's just, you know, and it's weird even to say that, but it's part of what people notice on stage. So,
yeah, true. And if you had like, you know, a lot of cleavage,
right,
then it's just human male instinct.
And even women, I mean, women look at me differently when I dress, you know, too provocatively, you know, in public. And I will say when I go out to eat and I'm wearing something low cut, my water gets refilled pretty constantly. you definitely get better service in a restaurant if you're dressed a certain way.
Well, what are other things that a female comedian would have to be conscious of? And what advice would you possibly give to help out a female comedian that would be starting?
Well, that's the thing is I know what I'm conscious of because the way I dress isn't just what I'm self-conscious of on stage. It's how I am every day. So that's, I would say my advice to any comedian and for women is to do what feels comfortable, because the more comfortable you are on stage, the more honest you can be, the easier it is to perform for people. You know, if that's what you want to do, if you some people create a character and they stick to that, and they, like Wendy Liebman has a very specific way of writing. Find out what your voice is. Do you want to be a joke writer? Do you want to be a storyteller? You know, the girl was asking me last night for advice, and I said, the best piece of advice I can give you is to not listen to anybody. And that was actually what Larry Miller told me 8 years ago. Was, you know, my best piece of advice is not to take anyone's advice. This is all, it's all trial and error. And when you listen to people, when you listen to those voices, the harder it is to hear yourself. Oh, well, they don't want me to talk about this, or I should talk about that, or I should dress this way. Find out what's comfortable for you. For me, it's dressing a certain way. And that's, and for doing my own material that comes from my life. Now that's the only thing I can tell. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's supposed to be about self-expression.
Right. It's supposed to be your, I mean, that's what art is. It's your, that's what I was saying last night. It's your piece of life. This is how I see life, whether it's, you know, through comedy and any artist does that, you know, the way they paint, the way they write music, it's coming from the way they see life. It's their slice.
Yeah. And, you know, you don't touch any of the taboo subjects that like people look down and expect from a female comedian, which is really refreshing. And like I said, your bravery about talking about, you know, the real things in your life is very impressive. What do you think about the Chicago comedy scene, and is it, are there a lot of great comedians here, or are you pretty much the last emperor?
No, I'm not the last emperor. No, there's actually some really strong up-and-coming comics, and they're also, I mean, the guys who stayed here, and, you know, they do corporate, or they travel, and there are different ways to crack this nut of comedy, you know, whether it's to get a sitcom. As always people think, is you have to be on Letterman, or you have to be on Leno, or Ferguson, and go to L.A. There's a lot of different ways to make a living at this and enjoy what you do. Corporate's harder now that the economy tanked a little bit, I think, for some of the guys. But there's still ways to go at this. And then there's guys like Mike Toomey and Steve Segrin. Oh, no, Segrin's in L.A. Never mind. Segrin found a way to crack that nut. But Tim Walco, Tim Clue, Vince Moranto. I mean, a lot of, you know, they're the guys. They're the guys that are the comedy scene. And I'm, you know, Larry Reeb. And I still am riding on their coattails. You know, I still do with what they established in Chicago. But the young people, Emily Galati, who was up last night, she's very smart. And Michael Palasak and Andy Woodhull, they're very strong joke writers. I'm very jealous. I try not to, you know, you still see somebody like, oh, I wish I'd written that joke. But no, it's a very strong scene, I believe. But yeah, that's not what we're known for. We're still people, if they're going to go out for comedy, they're going to go to Second City. So come to Zany's.
That's right, damn it. It's only a block away from Second City.
I know.
So when you go to Second City and it's sold out, come down to Zany's.
This club is a
holy temple of the haha, and it's been here forever. And I forgot about Larry Reeb. Larry Reeb.
You can't forget about Larry Reeb.
God, what a classic. I love Larry.
Yeah, I mean, he's brilliant. He's I mean, when I used to host for him, he'd always say, "Thanks, Petey." I just love the way he says my name. Thanks, Petey. It's such a great sound. We were at the playground yesterday, and someone was telling me they were a fan of his, and all the kids are running around. I'm like, and she wanted to do line. We can't do any lines around the children. Yeah, so he's very, very and even beyond that, I think comics still come back to Chicago. Comedy has changed. I mean, a lot of people want to go out if they're going to spend money now. They want to go out and they want to see the big ticket names in the comedy clubs. I think it's we're kind of scratching for those, you know, for attention a little bit. Maybe that's what's happened.
I don't know. Like you were saying that the corporate gigs are kind of drying up because of the economy. I've never been a corporate comedian guy. But I think actually stand-up comedy is on fire again because everybody's out of work. They're depressed.
Right.
And the economy, it's the same when the comedy boomed in the late 80s, early 90s. I think it's the same climate. And I think you're in the right spot, sister.
All
right,
then. I like being in the spot. This has always been my home club. You can't make me leave. They try.
No, there's no reason. You're a pillar of the society. So before we wrap it up, let's see. What joke of yours are you the most proud of that you've ever written?
Oh, the most proud of that I've ever written. I don't know. I mean, I already did the just because you can't talk doesn't mean you shouldn't. And it's not really a joke. It's a response.
That's the joke I love that you did about Declan. And that's the one that I saw the people clapping wildly.
And I have shirts that say, just because you can't talk doesn't mean you should. I don't know if I have anything there are things that I've done that I'm proud are what people recognize me for. Like about how men would be more involved in breast cancer awareness if we just called it Save the Boobies. You know, we have the walks, you know, jogging for jugs, hauling it for Hooters, trot for tatas. I have material, women's health, you know, when I talk about the stirrups, I do it because women are afraid to go and get their exams. And talking about it in a way, I mean, women have told me that they're in the stirrups and getting their exam and they think of me and laugh, which used to gross me out. But now I'm like, well, fine. If that's what it takes to get you in there and possibly save your life, I'll take it. So I have, talking about Declan, I'm proud of talking about the things that people don't expect me to or that nobody else does. Although I thought that, I went and did Last Comic Standing, and I did the joke about just because you can't talk doesn't mean you should. And Andy Kindler said I was interesting and I had a lot of energy, but the jokes just weren't landing. And I don't know the girl. I've never met the woman who was there. And Greg Giraldo said he loved me, which Greg and I have known each other for a long time, possibly 8 years. I talked to him afterwards, and he said that I was like the sixth or seventh female comedian who had a child who was sick or disabled. I know. What were the chances?
What? Now that's not a joke. Are you kidding me?
He's just like, you gotta be kidding me.
I'm blown away by that last night and the bravery and the honesty of talking about your life, and then Last Comic Standing tells you, that's kind of hack.
Exactly. Like, you gotta be kidding me. He said that one of the women left, and that he goes, when someone ends their audition with, well, I'm glad your son doesn't have cancer anymore. You know, they just don't know how to, they don't know how to talk to these moms. So when I walked in and said that about that, I mean, as soon as I said he had autism, which, like I said, I say it just because it's easier. Like I was like, did they just roll their eyes at me? Not another one. Because the first time I did Last Comic Standing, I was a finalist in Chicago. The second season, I was a finalist. And I made it to the top 10 or whatever it was for Chicago. And I didn't make it past Chicago. And then they aired the show, and they put me in the best of the worst, because there were 20 comics who did I'm half this, I'm half that, I'm half this, I'm half that. So that year, hack was my saying I was Irish and Mexican. So I was like, well, I didn't do any material about being Irish and Mexican. I'm going to do something that's very specifically me. My son is disabled. And they're like, seen it. What are the chances?
What are the chances?
I know. And someone told me don't do that. They were like, oh, don't talk about your kid. You know, it's too dark and whatever. I'm like, no, this is what sets me apart. I know that being Declan's mother and talking about his brother and talking about them sets me apart. And apparently it does not. Because I do. I even talk about Griffin. What I am so surprised by both of them is that I never know what to expect next. Like I was talking to Griffin's principal, and he was they're both going to school at a blended, they call it a blended school. They have able children and disabled children, like children with cerebral palsy and Downs and autism. And the principal pulled me aside to tell me how impressed he was with Griffin, my older son, because Griffin would ride the bus and read to the kids on the bus. And I said, I know.
Griffin is the best big brother Declan could have. And I believe that. I always have believed that since the moment that I had Declan. I was like, well, Griffin's so sweet, and this he'll get this. But at the same time, I still felt, I kind of felt guilty, like I like almost like I had done this to Griffin. Like this was going to be the rest of Griffin's life, was having possibly having a brother who's disabled. So I kind of carried that around for a long time. So we got in the car, and Griffin was like looking at me in the rear. I could see him in the rearview mirror, just kind of looking at me. And I said, "What's wrong, sweetie?" He goes, "Well, why didn't you tell Principal Smith that Declan's the best little brother I could have?" And I had to pull the car over. And he goes, "Mommy, what's wrong?" And I pulled the car over and I stopped and I got out and I had to open his door and give him the biggest kiss, because he gets it. He gets that this is the way things are supposed to be. And he's like, "Well, of course he's the best little brother I could have. What's wrong with Declan? This is the way it's supposed to be." And that's so hard to remember as you get older, as things get chipped away from you. You're like, "Well, you know, this isn't good enough, or I have to have more of this." And to Griffin, like, this is right. This is how it's supposed to be. And that's what he reminds. Both of them remind me of that. Right now is good. And that's why I am where I am, because right now is where I'm supposed to be.
Patty, you rock, and your spirit is so wonderful. And you've I mean, even before these tragedies of, just the tragedy of your father and what you've gone through with your children, not that that's a tragedy. I mean, just the toughness of life. You've had such a great spirit, and you're not, like a lot of comedians are bitter for a lot less things and things that are inconsequential, that mean nothing. And you know, you've, you know, championed going through your father's deterioration and then you know, raising your children, and I'm just being a mom, I think, would be tough any way you look at it. And you know, you're a bright ball of sunshine.
I did that often.
I want that to be on your press kit. A bright ball of sunshine, Tom Rhodes.
I get like teased for he said it. I get teased. Like, I was doing this all-female, all-funny show last night. We do it every month. And I think I introduced one of the girls. I said, "Yay," right? Bring up whoever, yay. And she, like, mocked me on stage for saying yay. And I was like, you know, I can't. People get mad at me for like being too happy, and I'm like, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to, you know, lay it all out there for what, why my life could suck? Because everybody's life could suck. You know, it's what you bring to it. How is it? What's that line? It's not what you've done. It's what you're gonna do. I can't. Oh, I know what it is. It's the alcoholism one. I can't control the things in my life. I can only control how I react to them. And that's true. I mean, that's absolutely true for everybody. So, you know, I judge myself on how I react to things. How can I step up? And that's just the way. But I've been like that since I was little. My mom asked me the same way. She has no idea where I came from. You know, I didn't. Maybe the second or third book, you'll be like, holy shit. Her dad and her kid was one thing. Who knew this bag of tricks was? Yeah, my whole life has not been. But that's, I don't know any other way. I'm like, I think when I was a kid, I was like Griffin. Well, I guess this is the way it is, you know. So I like life.
it's very apparent. And it's so refreshing to see that in a comedian. You know, I think sincerity is like the ultimate form of bravery in a comedian. And that if you're not bitter and angry, that's almost a revolution in itself in today's world of negativity and, you know, evil bloggers and, you know, just shitty YouTube comments and just whatever. Just, it seems like it's kind of the trendy fashion to be a little pissy snothead now.
Well, that's what I think for
comedy. I mean, even like you look at the sitcoms and right. what is American comedy? Well, it's all negativity and insults.
And that's why, and that trend, I think, has held me up, because when people come in, like you were saying, when they come in and they're scouting or whatever, I've had a woman from HBO has come to see me like 3 or 4 times, and this is what she says to me. She goes, "Patty, I think you're adorable. I love you. I fucking hate your material." Exactly. And she's from New York, and who knows if that's just the way you're supposed to be in New York, but that's what I think, that it's too bright and shiny and whatever. So I have to find my way in, and that I'm not going to change my material because, you know, I have to be darker or edgier. And that's what people would tell me. And when I do the sets for, you know, the various talk shows, I'm not dark enough. I'm not edgy enough. They say that to me, and I can't write that material for you. It's not what I do. You know, and I love the comedians that I see on HBO and that I see on all the talk shows. It's just, if I don't fit into that category, then I have to make my own category.
That blows me away, because I'm a comedian, and I think, God, you're so lovable and you're perfectly tailor-made for television.
Eh, whatever.
whatever.
We're not the gatekeepers. The gatekeepers have other ideas. So I have to find, you gotta find your keys. Where are my keys? It sounds like something from Ghostbusters. Wasn't there a gatekeeper in Ghostbusters? I am the gatekeeper. Are you the key? I think so. Wasn't Rick Moranis the gatekeeper, or was he looking for the gatekeeper?
Yeah, when the girl, what was it, Sigourney Weaver, when she got possessed by the devil or something?
Yeah. I love that. They're making another one, I think. They're going to make a third. I don't know why we tangent off to this, because I think talking about breast cancer, my dad dying, and hypoplasia of the corpus callosum got it too much for us.
I loved Ghostbusters, too. Back off, man. I'm a scientist. But yeah, I think... yeah, are they going to remake it? It's going to be Will Smith, another Will Smith vehicle.
Are they really?
Is it, I have no idea. I'm just guessing.
The original guys. They're not remaking it. They're making a third. I don't know if they.
Oh, with the original guys. Oh, great.
Yeah, I think I believe, and I don't know if I'm not supposed to say anything, but I think that they. I think it's out there news that Harold Ramis and I think Kazurinsky. I get to meet Tim Kazurinsky. Do you know from Saturday Night Live? You know who Tim Kazurinsky is. This would be embarrassing if you don't know Tim Kazurinsky. Now he's looking for his picture. I met him the other day, and he came up to me in front of my mom and told me how funny I was. And I was like, thank you for making me look good in front of my mom. She thinks I'm a failure. No, she doesn't. But
I would shit in my pants to meet Harold Ramis.
I met Harold Ramis. I shared a dressing room with him. Very sweet guy. Very generous. Very nice.
He wrote Groundhog's Day, yeah. Which I think is the single greatest ingenious comedy ever made.
Do you have a car while you're here? You can go see the town square where it was shot. You can go see where it's in Woodstock, Illinois.
Are you fucking kidding me?
I'm kidding you. Go to Woodstock, Illinois. That's the town square. It's only about 20 minutes from St. Charles. That's
what Ned Ryerson. Yeah, when I had my sitcom, I played a school teacher and
I saw the show, Mr. Rhodes.
The principal was Stephen Tobolowsky, and he was Ned Ryerson. Anyway. Yeah, the sitcom. No, it became a children's show. Like episode number 3. I felt like the second banana on my own show. Oh my God, the kids get to do another silly dance. Oh, great. I'll be over here on the side on my own show. Sure.
At least if it was your own show, at least if they just let that happen and then whatever, you'd be like, who was the guy that was, now I can't remember, from WKRP in Cincinnati. And then Howard Hessman, didn't he have his own show where he was a teacher and then the show became about the students instead of the teacher?
Well, that was the thing. My original thing was I wanted to be a public defender. You know, the voice of the voiceless, like a comedian. And then I also, Barney Miller was one of my favorite shows growing up. And I thought it would be something gritty. And then there would always be the cameo guest appearances like Barney Miller had of the, you know, people revolving through the court. And as a comedian, I would have my little, you know, kind of say in front of the court, defending the people who couldn't afford counsel. And then about 6 months before we did the pilot, NBC said, we just had a lawyer show fail. Can you make Tom a teacher? And, it, you know, and the guy that that wrote the pilot for the public defender idea was one of my best friends, Mark Brazil. When my show was done, he went on to co-create that 70s show.
Oh.
So now he lives in a big mansion with, I think he has 20 horses in his stables in the backyard. But so we thought, oh, well, we could do this with a teacher show. We can make this work. And actually the pilot episode of my show was brilliant. And they took 4 of my jokes from my act and put it in the pilot. And everybody loved the pilot. That's why they made it a series. But who knew that same year there were like 5 teacher shows.
Right.
Somebody knew somewhere that it was some, you know, wow, there's going to be all these teacher shows. So, I mean, I kind of got killed by accepting the teacher show idea, I think.
Right, right. Yeah, no, it's a shame because it was good. I liked your show. I don't even remember. What were the other shows?
Oh, my God. There was like Mr. Whatever.
Mr. Cooper.
Hanging with Mr. Cooper. There was Nick Freno. There was all these.
Oh, and those were all, but those were like was it the WB yet? It was something, they were all like on the network that, not major network, right? I think that was, and you were on NBC. You should have been the shit.
My show was on Mondays at 8:30 on NBC. It was against Monday Night Football.
Oh, no.
And also Melrose Place, which was very popular with women at the time. So the only people that watched my show were eunuchs.
And me. I was watching your show. Me and the eunuchs were hanging out watching your show.
But I think about this when I come to Chicago. When the season started, they first flew everybody to New York, and we all they introduced all the shows at Lincoln Center, and we all walked out on the stage one at a time. And it was so cool to be all these NBC shows. And I actually did a shot of tequila with Brooke Shields hanging out. Me, Brooke Shields, and John Lithgow.
Oh, nice.
We're talking at this after party. Third Rock from the Sun. And then we came to Chicago, and there was a big to-do here introduction, and it was really stupid. My show was like the first one announced, and I came out, and I was supposed to say something, and I just said, it's a great time to be in Chicago, and it's a great time to be on NBC or something. I didn't know what to say. I was like just cripplingly stupid.
Oh, Tom.
Anyway, but I had it. So anyway, well, Patty, I love you to death. In closing, is there any words of wisdom or advice you would like to give to the people of the earth?
I am all out of wisdom. I don't know. I'm not old. In 10 years, in 8 years, we'll do wisdom.
Eight more years.
I'll still be in Chicago, I think. I think I'll still be here. Come to Chicago. That's my only word of wisdom. Come see Chicago in the summertime, please, in June. I don't know. I think I've shared everything I've got. I'm empty.
You should be the hottest thing in Chicago. I hope that you just sell out everywhere and that you play theaters and and Zanies, of course.
Thank you very much. It's very sweet. Thank you so much. And it was great to see you. I'm so glad you came in last.
Wonderful to see you. We've always been great friends. And like I said, I'm so proud of what you're doing as a comedian. And hooray for you, Patty.
Yay. Thank you very much.